It's now my great pleasure to introduce Lucy Ellis. So Lucy is the Assistant Governor Economic at the Reserve Bank of Australia, a position she has held since December 2016. Lucy is responsible for the bank's economic analysis and economic research departments and is the Chief Economic Advisor to the Governor and the Board. She's also the executive sponsor of the bank's LGBTI Plus Allies Employee Resource Group. Lucy has been a member of the Australian Statistics Advisory Council since November 2015. Prior to her current role, Lucy was head of Financial Stability Department for 8 years. She also served as deputy head of the Economic Analysis Department and spent almost 2 years on secondment at the Bank of International Settlements. Lucy holds a PhD from the University of New South Wales, a Master's in Economics degree from the Australian National University, and a first class Bachelor of Commerce with honours degree from the University of Melbourne. Lucy would normally have a thunderous round of applause right now as you walk up to a podium, but given our circumstances, I'll merely hand over to you.
Well, thanks very much, Stephen, and thank you to the Australian Business Economist for hosting this webcast. A short while ago, the bank released its regular statement on monetary policy, or SMP, as we like to call it. And that included details of our updated outlook. But these times are far from regular. Australia, along with the rest of the world, has been subjected to a shock without modern precedent. The COVID-19 pandemic has induced an enormous contraction in the global economy. Labour markets have been severely disrupted everywhere. The policy response has also been enormous, from public health agencies to financial regulators, central banks and fiscal authorities. All arms of public policy are needed to deal with the health crisis and support the recovery. Today, I'd like to take you through some of the detail on the outlook and provide some background on the thinking and analysis behind those numbers. As we did 3 months ago, today we're presenting three separate scenarios. We're doing this to provide more guidance on the range of uncertainty in the current environment. There are many potential risks and uncertainties at present. The main one, though, is the spread of the virus, both here and abroad. The difficult situation in Victoria is an example of how quickly this can change. So that is the dimension our various scenarios rest on. I'll talk about the upside and downside scenarios later. In the first instance, I'll focus on the baseline scenario while being mindful of the uncertainty surrounding it. Different countries have had different experiences with the pandemic. In one group of countries, including the United States and a range of emerging market economies, COVID-19 infection rates have escalated. Another group of countries, including South Korea, China, New Zealand, and much of Western Europe, has so far managed to get infection rates down and keep them there. In a third group of countries, infection rates had been at low levels, but have since escalated in fresh outbreaks. This group includes Australia, but also Japan, and a range of countries in Eastern Europe. These differing experiences will necessarily shape both the initial contractions and the subsequent recoveries in each economy. But in most cases, we can see the same broad narrative. There is an initial phase of an extremely large and sudden contraction in activity as governments impose lockdowns and other activity restrictions in order to control the virus, and people engage in voluntary social distancing in response to concerns about the virus. This phase has generally lasted a couple of months. As infection rates fall and activity restrictions are eased, activity begins to recover quite quickly over the course of the next few months. The phase of rapid recovery is usually only partial, however. With a few more months behind us, it has become clear that activity has not fully returned to pre-outbreak norms. This is apparent from the data on movement of people and in more conventional economic indicators and surveys. There are a number of reasons why activity is unlikely to bounce back completely after lockdowns end. Firstly, some activity restrictions usually remain even after the most stringent lockdown measures are lifted. Secondly, some people continue to engage in some social distancing beyond what is mandated. Thirdly, and probably most importantly, the deficiency in demand and a general increase in uncertainty induces people and firms to be more cautious in their spending decisions. So, demand remains weak for some time. This lingering effect of the pandemic on uncertainty and demand means that beyond the first couple of months, recoveries will be protracted and uneven. It will take time to get back to the level of global GDP prevailing before the pandemic. Taking 2020 as a whole, global GDP is expected to contract by more than 4%, before rising by nearly 6% in 2021. If realised, this outcome would still leave GDP below where it would have been had the outbreak not occurred. The pattern is very similar for Australia's major trading partners, which is what we're showing here. However, the contraction occurred earlier and the recovery is expected to be a bit more vigorous in China than in our other major trading partners. In Australia, the story is fairly similar. We estimate that activity contracted severely in the June quarter of this year, but began to recover late in the quarter. The situation in Victoria will reduce growth in the September quarter and push out the recovery beyond that. That said, activity is expected to continue to recover in much of the country over the rest of this year and next. That recovery is expected to be slow and uneven, and GDP will probably take several years to return to the trend path expected prior to the virus outbreak. A contraction in demand of this size represents an enormous shock to the labour market. Employment declined by more than 850,000 in April and May. Although some people regained employment in June, the unemployment rate increased by more than 2 percentage points over these 3 months. The increase would have been much greater were it not for the JobKeeper program, which preserved many employment relationships over this period. We expect that employment and total hours worked will decline over the next few months, partly because of the increased activity restrictions in Victoria. Elsewhere, the recovery in employment and hours should continue, but there could be setbacks. Payroll data suggests that the recovery in employment began to falter in the second half of June and into July, even before the lockdown in Melbourne came into effect. In this baseline scenario, we expect the unemployment rate to continue to increase over the rest of this year. Indeed, unemployment is expected to increase in all three scenarios. The current activity restrictions in Victoria will result in some further job losses there. In addition, an unusually large fraction of people did not actively look for work in April and May because there are, in many cases, simply no suitable jobs to apply for during periods of activity restrictions. So they are recorded as having left the labour force, not as unemployed. Over time, and as job opportunities become more evident, we expect that many of these people will start actively looking for jobs again. This increase in labour force participation is expected to outpace any recovery in employment outside Victoria in the second half of this year. The main driver of the initial contraction has been consumption. Many categories of consumption were simply not permitted during the height of the lockdowns. Even now, some are still not permitted, such as overseas tourism. People substituted by suspending on other things. In particular, they bought goods rather than services. But substitution can only go so far, so quickly. We estimate that household consumption declined over 10% over the first half of the year. Now, we expect consumption to recover some of this decline quite quickly. In fact, it already has. Part of this is a response to the expansion in consumption opportunities as businesses reopen. It is also made possible because there has been income support to help sustain this. Although many people lost their jobs over recent months, government support has meant that total household income has not fallen in aggregate. This has been a surprising outcome of the current episode. On top of the income transfers, many households have added to their available cash flow by withdrawing from their superannuation. Closure of international borders to most movements of people is affecting Australia's international trade and will continue to do so over the forecast period. International tourism will be infeasible until borders reopen and will probably only recover slowly. This will affect both services exports and services imports. Before the pandemic, tourism imports, spending by Australians travelling overseas, substantially exceeded tourism exports. Education exports are also an important component of Australia's international trade. This includes spending by foreign students when they're in Australia, as well as direct revenues such as university fees. Many students did manage to get to Australia before the borders closed. So, unlike tourism, this component of services exports will not fall to essentially zero, but it has fallen significantly. We project that education exports will remain broadly stable over the next year. This expectation is predicated on the assumption that allowances will be made for some international students to arrive for the start of the 2021 academic year. Business investment is likely to be weak in the near term and will take some time to recover. This is only partly a result of the activity restrictions. For example, construction activity was able to continue during stage three restrictions. Site shutdowns in response to virus outbreaks have also been quite rare. So non-residential construction projects that were already underway have mostly been able to continue. However, the announced Stage 4 restrictions in Melbourne limit the number of workers on a site, and so they will constrain commercial and residential construction activity there. The main reason for the weak investment outlook, though, is that many businesses across Australia have put investment plans on hold in response to the environment of weak demand and heightened uncertainty. This has been a particular issue for machinery and equipment investment because this category of investment spending is more sensitive to demand conditions. Dwelling investment is also expected to be weak in the period ahead. This is partly a function of the mandated reductions in activity in Victoria over coming months, with weak incomes and employment, as well as more generalised uncertainty weighing on people's decisions to buy homes. Demand will also be reduced during the period that international borders are closed because population growth will be significantly lower. The home builder policy is expected to provide some countervailing support in the near term, mostly for detached housing. Weak demand for housing is already affecting the market for rental housing. Many people changed their living arrangements in recent months to save money during the period of lockdown. The decline in international visitors and domestic business travellers because of travel restrictions has also encouraged some landlords to offer their short-term rental accommodation on the long-term market. That response increases the available rental stock. As a result, rental vacancy rates have increased significantly in Sydney and Melbourne. Many tenants have obtained discounts on their existing rental agreements. Advertised rents have also fallen of late. We expect that demand for rental housing will remain weak for a while yet. With international borders closed, immigration to Australia has essentially halted, and so population growth will slow noticeably. Weak labour market conditions will also discourage some people, especially young people, from forming new households. The weak outlook for rents is one of the factors that is likely to weigh on inflation over the next couple of years. Looking at the near term, though, temporary factors are driving large movements in inflation in the June and September quarters. Headline CPI declined by 2% in the June quarter. This decline is entirely accounted for by two factors: the fall in petrol prices and the decision to make childcare and some preschool free. Growth in some other prices, particularly groceries, was higher than it had been in some years. Large movements in prices in both directions, as well as some measurement challenges, make the underlying trend in inflation harder to discern. We can look through these effects as much as possible by using various measures of underlying inflation. This suggests that the underlying trend declined to be closer to zero in the quarter rather than the large negative recorded in the headline CPI. Most of the decline in headline CPI will reverse in the September quarter. Petrol prices increased a little in recent months, and fees for childcare and preschool are being progressively reintroduced. So there will be some further volatility in the headline inflation figures. This volatility will be less evident in the various underlying measures. Beyond the next quarter or so, we expect inflation to be low. Spare capacity in the economy and the resulting weak growth in labour costs are likely to put downward pressure on inflation for some time. We expect inflation to increase a little as the economy recovers. Unsurprisingly, this pickup is a bit faster in the upside scenario than in the baseline. And in the downside scenario, it can be expected to take quite a while before turning around. While the overall spare capacity in the economy is the main driver of the inflation outlook, some other factors will also be important. As well as the expected weakness in rents, weak demand for housing will affect prices of new homes, though changes in supply will also matter. Governments could also decide to reduce pressures on the cost of living by freezing or lowering administered prices, as we've already seen for childcare and preschool. It's uncertain how all these forces will play out. The course of the virus is very uncertain, and so will be people's responses to it. Given this uncertainty, we have again presented the outlook in the form of three scenarios, complementing the baseline scenario I've just described with an upside and a downside scenario. The baseline scenario is based on the assumption that infection rates in Australia subside. The recent tightening of restrictions in Victoria is assumed to be successful, and there are no new lockdowns imposed elsewhere. Restrictions are assumed to be eased progressively over the rest of the year. The upside scenario also assumes that infection rates fall quickly and stay low. The pace of decline in case numbers is assumed to be a bit faster than in the baseline, so the restrictions are eased a bit faster too. This would be similar to the experience of some of the smaller states in Australia in recent months. People also take more comfort from this, and confidence recovers faster than in the baseline scenario. Households are therefore willing to spend more of the savings they accumulated during the first half of this year, compared with what is assumed in the baseline scenario. The downside scenario assumes that infection rates continue to escalate around the world this year and next. Australia itself faces a series of outbreaks and periods of stage 3 or stage 4 restrictions in some states. The result is further near-term weakness in activity. Confidence is damaged, and so the recovery is much slower as well. The extent of the damage would depend on how widespread and long-lasting renewed restrictions need to be to get control over the spread of the virus. The other main point of variation between these three scenarios is how long Australia's international borders remain closed. 3 months ago, we were assuming that travel restrictions would be lifted by the end of this year. Our current scenarios are based on an assumption that it is more likely that our borders will remain closed to most travellers until at least the middle of next year. Some longer-term visitors, such as those on student visas, are assumed to begin arriving early next year, subject to appropriate quarantine restrictions. But tourists and other short-term visitors will not be able to return until later. In the baseline and upside scenarios, we assume that the borders reopen in mid-2021. In the downside scenario, where the global spread of the virus does not subside as quickly, we assume the borders are closed for all of 2021. Now, it's always possible to construct other scenarios. The near term would be stronger if there were a major medical breakthrough on treatments soon. An effective vaccine would take a bit longer to be distributed, so it would mainly affect outcomes next year and the year after. But it could also result in a stronger recovery than we've assumed, even in the upside scenario presented here. On the other hand, a worse outcome than our downside could be conceivable if the virus cannot be contained and further waves of infection occur around the world for some years yet. There are also plenty of other risks that can be contemplated. We discussed some of these in the statement. Geopolitical tensions were an issue even before the coronavirus outbreak, and they could escalate further. The pandemic has also, in some places, exacerbated domestic political tensions. It is hard to know how these tensions will play out over the next couple of years. If they escalate, it is possible that some countries' recoveries will be derailed. Domestically, there are also a number of uncertainties that go beyond the direct effect of the virus and associated activity restrictions. For example, we've assumed that households and businesses are quite cautious in their use of the fiscal and other cash flow support that they've been receiving. It is possible that people spend more out of that support than we're assuming. It's even possible that some people do more to make up for the consumption opportunities that were not available during periods of lockdown and other activity restrictions. On the downside, the longer the economy remains weak, the more the recovery will be impeded by scarring effects on workers, the destruction of business supply networks, and other lingering damage. The scenarios presented in the statement incorporate several lessons from the experience of the past few months. First, the economic contractions induced by health-related restrictions on the activity in the June quarter were very large. However, they were not quite as severe as initially expected. The peak-to-trough declines in output and hours worked have been smaller than we'd expected in May. This seems to have been partly because the restrictions in Australia didn't amount to a complete lockdown, and partly because they were lifted a bit earlier than expected. Another reason for the smaller contraction was, as noted earlier, that fiscal transfers did a lot to replace lost income. This has helped sustain employment through periods of lockdown. It has also supported household consumption, which has recovered sooner than expected. A similar pattern has been evident in other advanced economies. Second, while the part of the contraction directly attributable to the initial health measures turned out to be smaller, general uncertainty and responses to weak demand seem to have accounted for more of the downturn in output and the labour market than earlier envisaged. This has been evident in the industry pattern of employment effects, as well as the weakness in investment intentions both in Australia and abroad. After an initial rebound in payroll jobs in the most affected industries, the recovery in the Australian labour market has been quite patchy. Consequently, we now think that even though the initial contraction was smaller, the subsequent recovery is likely to be more protracted and progress on reducing unemployment will be slower. Third, and related to the previous point, while the decline in total hours worked was smaller than we thought, it was tilted more to job losses rather than the declines in average hours than we'd earlier expected. And more of the people who exited employment left the labour force entirely. This implies that there is more spare capacity in the labour market than a straight read of unemployment would suggest. Fourth, over the first half of the year, fiscal policy measures managed to keep aggregate household income broadly steady at the same time that household consumption contracted substantially. Some households have therefore built up buffers of savings, intentionally or otherwise, that they would not normally have accumulated. Similarly, recent withdrawals from superannuation could be used to tide some households over in a period of income loss. Household incomes are forecast to decline later in the year when JobKeeper starts to taper off and the mutual obligation conditions for JobKeeper are reimposed. But partly because of these accumulated savings, we do not expect this temporary setback to incomes to derail growth in household consumption. Fifth, the large persistent rise in case numbers in Victoria and the ensuing introduction of stage four restrictions there were not anticipated. Now, this is not exactly a lesson for our earlier forecasts, but it does show how quickly things can change in a pandemic. The statement on monetary policy contains more detail on the outlook and other issues that I have not covered today. It represents the culmination of our analysis of the economy and financial markets over the past few months and is the product of the hard work of many bank staff. In my talk today, I've focused on the bank's outlook rather than all the other material presented in the statement or the details of the fiscal and monetary policy response. These have been discussed in detail elsewhere. I would nonetheless like to conclude with a few brief remarks on how both fiscal and monetary policy have shaped our view of the economic outlook. The COVID-19 pandemic has been the most profound shock to the economy and society in many decades. All arms of public policy need to pull together to combat the spread of the virus and support the economy through the recovery. Monetary and fiscal policy are key parts of that response. The package of measures introduced by the Reserve Bank Board in mid-March are intended to support the Australian economy by keeping funding costs low and credit available. The Board's assessment is that so far, these measures are working as intended. Funding costs for banks, firms and households are all very low. Credit remains available, and other policies have meant that borrowers in difficulty have been able to defer their repayments if needed. Likewise, the transfers to households and businesses coming from fiscal policy have supported incomes during this difficult period and provide a platform for the recovery. The JobKeeper program and various support for businesses have also ensured that employment relationships have been preserved to date and that viable businesses can tide themselves over during this period of disruption. On Tuesday, the board affirmed its commitment to do what it can to support jobs, incomes and businesses in Australia. It will maintain this accommodative approach for as long as this support is required to help build the bridge to the recovery. Thanks very much for your attention and I welcome your questions.
Oh, thank you, Lucy. That's a great summary of the Reserve Bank's thinking. So thanks very much for running through all those ideas. And thank you also for agreeing to take questions. So we've had a couple pop up in the Q&A box, and I've also had some questions sent to me separately. So I might actually start with a couple of those. And one of them relates to the fiscal policy response that you just alluded to. So you would have seen, obviously, this morning some announcements from the federal government about extension of JobKeeper, particularly for businesses in Victoria. Mm. I know the forecasts were finalised before that announcement, but have you got any thoughts on what sort of impact that may have on the near-term profile of the economy?
Yes, so the forecasts were finalised before last night's announcement. They were finalised after the Stage 4 restrictions. So this does mean that the recovery will be a little stronger. Hard to say exactly how much as yet. A lot of it really does depend on how quickly the Stage 4 restrictions are managed to be successful and how quickly we can step down in Victoria. We still think that hours worked will probably decline, but employment won't decline as much as the forecasts that we published suggest. We still think that average hours worked will decline in large part because a lot of people a lot of people will be on JobKeeper. The more people are on JobKeeper, the more people are being paid but are on zero hours. So average hours worked will come down. That does imply that there's still quite a bit of spare capacity. So yes, at the margin, the announcements last night do attenuate the weakness in the September and December quarters, but we still think it's a pretty weak outlook because, you know, the important point here is that the activity restrictions restrict activity, and so you can't actually undo that with fiscal support. You can tide yourselves over, you can build the bridge to recovery, but you can't undo the necessary activity restrictions to stop the spread of the virus, and nor should you try.
Thanks, Lucy. There's a question here from John Diller, a former colleague of mine here at Treasury.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the vaccine potential in your prepared comments, but John's question's about, it sounds like you don't have any specific timing on a vaccine. It's sort of hopeful. And
I know a lot of people are working on the assumption that there will be a vaccine soon. Our forecasts are basically robust of there being no vaccine next year. We're working on the assumption that even if a vaccine is, you know, gets through stage three testing in the next little while, the global rollout of that takes some time. You've still got to manufacture it. You've still got to distribute it. And this is a global issue. And so this is, you know, it may sort of enable, you know, if it is distributed in Australia, it might mean that you're closer to the upside on terms of your domestic activity, but it's unlikely that you'd be able to open borders much earlier than what we've projected. So we're not assuming that there's a vaccine anytime soon. That if there is a vaccine approved soon, it would still take a while to come through. So we would think that's more something for 2022 profile rather than the near term.
Thank you. Here's one from Matthew Cranston from the Financial Review. So how does the RBA think certain restrictions could be better applied or targeted to ensure that activity is not hit for the sake of incremental health benefits? That may be one better targeted to perhaps fiscal policy, but while you're here, I'm happy to hear your thoughts.
Look, activity restrictions and test, trace, quarantine are the things that get on top of this virus. You don't get a strong economy without getting a hold of this virus. I mean, I don't think that you can dismiss that as being some kind of trade-off. I think what we've seen around the world is that economies that have not had a good handle on the virus but have not restricted activity haven't really had any better economic performance than those that did a very quick lockdown very quickly. Getting on top of the virus is what will enable a strong recovery.
Thanks, Lucy. Here's one from Cillian Ong from RBC. So do you worry that confidence and especially business confidence will weaken and take longer to recover compared to earlier this year with longer term implications for investment, activity, hiring, and that it's adding to the fragile recovery?
We do worry about that. And in fact, that's really that sort of second lesson I talked about in my talk, that a bit less of the contraction has been because of the activity restrictions and a bit more of it has been because businesses pulled in their horns. Now, we've accounted for that effect in our forecasts already. Of course, it could be worse, and it really is up to businesses to sort of take advantage of the fact that maybe some of the people they want to buy services from or buy equipment from are ready to take your call and sell something to you. So it really does come down to businesses being willing to take those risks. And if they're feeling uncertain, if they're very feeling worried about the future, if they're worried about the future economy, there is that risk that they'll pull their horns in, reduce investment even more than we have forecast, but we are forecasting a big reduction in investment.
And can I ask you a supplementary to that, actually, because I know the bank puts a lot of emphasis, or I'm told the bank puts a lot of emphasis on the NAB business survey, which clearly is monthly. Mm. What other information do you get? Like, I know you have your liaison program where you talk to various businesses and others. Is that particularly useful now, given the NAB survey is obviously a very good survey, but it's only monthly? Like, how do you get those sort of intervening feedback from business? Is it the liaison program?
Yes, our liaison program has been absolutely instrumental in our understanding of this crisis, and the feedback from our liaison partners in our business liaison program has been invaluable. Yes, the NAB survey and many other business surveys are useful. I think one of the lessons of this episode of the pandemic has been, just how much people can integrate new sources of information into their traditional indicator, into their traditional information set. But we've had a business liaison program now for nearly 20 years, and once again, it has really proven how, its usefulness in our understanding of what is happening.
Here's one from Michael Yander. So what are the RBA's assumptions around government fiscal support, such as JobKeeper and JobSeeker coronavirus supplement? Do you assume they'll wind down as currently planned, or do you? I'll extend that question and say, do you essentially have the same assumptions as the federal government?
Yes, we align our assumptions around the parameters of fiscal support to what has been most recently announced. So that was the July announcements. We don't try and second guess what they might announce later,
okay, thank
including
you.
What they announced last night.
Indeed. Here's one from Nikki Hutley from Deloitte's Access Economics. So given the outlook for unemployment, are you concerned about the ability of the banks to continue to sustain delayed mortgage repayments?
It's a very good question, and I think it highlights one of the differences between a pandemic and a conventional downturn, is that normally, you know, in historical downturns and recessions, it's usually the financial sector is often at the center of the causes. It's often a financial crisis or weakness in the financial sector that makes things more problematic or starts that downturn. This time around, it's a health crisis. It's not a conventional economic downturn. And we go into this period with highly capitalized, profitable lenders. And I think that really does suggest that there is a lot more sort of buffer to withstand and support the economy and support households and businesses through this difficult period than you would have seen in other downturns.
Thanks, Lucy. Here's one from Tapas Strickland at NAB. So with trimmed inflation downgraded between 1% and 1.5% over the forecast horizon, and the RBA effectively limiting what more it can do in the sense that the governor's ruled out effectively negative interest rates, has the effective inflation target been lowered?
Thanks for the question, Tapas. It's an important point. So firstly, as we mentioned in the statement on monetary policy and the board in the governor's media release on Tuesday, the board hasn't ruled out doing more, but it has ruled out doing things that it thinks will be counterproductive or not effective in the current circumstances. So we haven't completely ruled that out, doing more. It is difficult, there's a lot of uncertainty around these forecasts. And so certainly our three scenarios do have inflation down below 2% over the horizon. We can't rule out that actually, if things come back faster, inflation pressures will also come back faster. We can't rule out that we have underdone the supply side effects of this health crisis. It is very different from your typical downturn. We do see there being a deficiency of demand, and that's driving our inflation forecasts, but we can't rule out that it's also more of a supply side than we're factoring in. We haven't walked away from the inflation target. It's an important part of the way we frame our commitment in legislation to pursue the economic welfare of the people of Australia. But the medium term is the medium term, and maybe I think this is a lesson that the forecast horizon isn't necessarily the same time period over which we commit to getting back to above two, because in a circumstance like this, where we've had the most enormous contraction in the economy and disruption to labour markets, it may just take a little bit longer than you would expect in a more regular economic cycle.
Thanks, Lucy. Here's one from Leanne Taylor from CBUS. So what is your view on the US economic cycle, given they, on so much evidence, don't seem to have the virus under control? Did you want to make any specific comments about the US?
We don't publish country by country forecasts, and we don't feel we can materially improve on what forecasters outside the building can do on some of these other countries. But it is fair to say that the lack of control over the virus and the difficulty in getting those health restrictions to stick, and the difficulty in getting the spread of the virus to be contained in the United States is a serious worry. It really has been, quite an exception relative to many other countries where you have seen, a period where infection rates have come down a long way and stayed low. Obviously, the experience in Victoria shows that things can break out again. It's also happened in Japan, but the ability to get on top of this, even multiple times, is very different to what you've seen in the US. So, we are very worried that concerns about the virus will actually weigh on growth in the US for some time yet. And, of course, the connection between that and political tensions is clearly front of mind.
Thanks, Lucy. There's a question here from Michael Potter, and I think it's been a common question that I receive as well. Are there any gaps in the real-time data? You mentioned the liaison program is doing a great job, but are there any other gaps that the Reserve Bank would like to see addressed? Like, I know the banks have got great data on card transactions and the like, and various governments have lots of data on mobility and the like. Is there anything else the bank would really love to have to see what's going on?
I'm not sure I'm ready to sort of come up with a quick wish list. We always want more data, and certainly during this period we have consumed data sets that we didn't previously consume. The traditional ones still remain important. I think I'd like to give a shout out to the ABS and the tax office for making the payrolls numbers available. That has been really helpful in getting near time, much nearer time understanding of the labour market. I think, you know, in this modern world, you know, we're doing this as a webcast, but there are so many sources of data that perhaps are a little bit untapped, and I would encourage all businesses and all government agencies that might actually have a window on this. It might only be partial. I mean, certainly each of the banks only has a partial lens into the economy, and you've got to add them up to really get a representative view. But we learn a little bit from each of those data sets. Each of them is a tile in the mosaic, and we put it together to try and make sense. But yeah, so more is better, and I don't think I'd call out anything that I particularly feel is lacking. We put together a team to look at some of these new data sets, and that's been really, really beneficial.
Fantastic, thank you. Julie Toth has asked a question about productivity and the underlying problems with weak productivity in Australia. Do you think productivity growth actually will be weakened further by the crisis and possibly get a much needed boost out of necessity on the alternative?
I think Julie, who I've known for a long time, has hit the nail on the head that it could go both ways. I think this is something that we really need to grapple with. Everyone has gone home. This is only the second day I've been in the office since March. And, whole swathes of industries have discovered you can work productively from home. Others have found it's more difficult. The need for social distancing, cleaning, more security, these things are changing your cost base and changing the ease with which you have to do business. But on the other hand, there are things, people have focused on what's important. And whether that's your family or the activities that are really necessary for your business to thrive, I think these periods have created a lot of focus. So absolutely, it could go both ways. And I think this is one of the big questions we're going to be watching in the next little while.
Thanks, Lucy. There's one from Joe Masters at EY. Thank you for your comments. You've spoken about unemployment and inflation, but could you make some comments around the Reserve Bank's focus on financial stability and any concerns that might have been that might have emerged from the COVID recession?
Thanks. I mean, obviously, this is the statement on monetary policy, and the financial stability review will be released in September. So I don't really want to preview what's going to be in there. What I would emphasise is this is a period of extreme contraction. There will be a lot of people who have lost income. There will be a lot of people who are struggling to get on top of their debts. On the other hand, there are people who are actually being supported through this with fiscal support and are using that opportunity to accumulate funds in their mortgage offset and redraw accounts or get on top of some of the debts that they've gotten behind upon. I mean, one of the things we have heard in liaison is that for some people, this has actually been an opportunity to get ahead of where they've been. So we're very mindful of the diversity of experiences that we're seeing in the Australian economy at present. We're always mindful of financial stability risks. But as I mentioned earlier, we're coming into this period with a financial sector that is strong and is well capitalised and profitable and is in much better shape to contribute to the support for the economy to build that bridge to recovery.
No, thanks, Lucy. There's a question here from Sean Langcake, and I suppose it comes to the earlier comments about the inflation target, but can you give us the bank's assessment of inflation expectations, and is there a material risk that the pandemic will entrench lower expectations for inflation?
It is certainly possible. On the other hand, I'm very mindful, at least for the household sector, there will be people who've been noticing that grocery prices have gone up. If you're not enjoying though, if you don't drive around much and you're not enjoying free childcare, for you, your consumption basket may have gone up. We're very mindful of the diversity of experiences. So I think it could go either way in terms of inflation over the next little while, in terms of inflation expectations over the next little while. It's it's not a lay-down misere that inflation expectations will decline, but the longer the decline in activity, the longer the period of high unemployment goes on, the longer the wage freezes and other measures are locked in, the more likely it is that inflation expectations will slow down.
Okay. There's one here from Anonymous that I'll raise, Lucy, about you mentioned China earlier on in your prepared comments. Mm. The trade data that came out this week, I think, showed that China's taking nearly half of Australia's goods exports. Mm. Is that, I mean, that's great that China's growing so robustly relative to the rest of the world, but does that raise some concerns in the context of the comments around geopolitical risks that you mentioned?
I'm not sure I would connect it to geopolitical risk just at this stage. I think, you know, this is really telling you, you know, the story that China has recovered, as I mentioned, a little faster than we thought. And, you know, that is, again, a testament to what is possible if you do get control over the virus and you are willing to do localized lockdowns where necessary to deal with outbreaks. China has had a somewhat different recovery to some other countries, because, you know, the nature of the support that they've provided has been more tilted towards their industrial sector than household income support. And so what you've seen is, you know, more of a recovery in their production side, in their industrial side, than in the sort of retail sales and the sort of things that you've seen elsewhere. And their industrial sector, and particularly their infrastructure, is very steel intensive. And what do you need to make steel? You need coal and iron ore. So iron ore prices have actually come up to, you know, almost as high as they've been since 2014. I mean, they're back at the levels they were after the, you know, the Vale Dam disaster 18 months ago. So, you know, this is a really big change. And so revenues for iron ore will be much higher than what we would have thought even a couple of months ago. And that's really what that's saying. It's really telling you about the nature of their recovery. Yes, in the current environment with heightened geopolitical risks, there could be spillovers from that, but at this stage, it's really telling you about the relative speed of recovery in different economies.
Thanks, Lucy. There's one here from John Kehoe, Australian Financial Review, and it's on housing. So house price falls seem to be accelerating, and the situation in Victoria will worsen that. How much of a risk is a negative feedback from steeper falls in house prices hitting wealth, consumption, and confidence?
I mean, I think, you know, that is part of the dynamic that we're going to see in housing for the next little while. While you have activity restrictions, there are less transactions, people are concerned about their income, so they may be less inclined to jump into a new house purchase. And, of course, as I mentioned in my talk, population growth is going to be a bit slower for a little while. On the other hand, there are going to be people who are starting to think that maybe they need a new home office and maybe they need to move to a bigger place. So, again, you know, there are complex human responses to this. And I think it's important not to always see the economy through the lens of the established housing market. It's one important element of the housing market, of the economy, but it's not the only part. It is certainly something we're mindful of, and I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, the fact that there are these potential for spillover effects and sort of spirals of confidence is one of the reasons why it is so important for public policy to do as much as it can to support the economy through the period of activity restrictions and build that bridge to the recovery.
Thanks, Lucy. We'll make this the final question. It's from Michael Yander again. Does the RBA anticipate long-term structural changes from the economy or for the economy coming from the pandemic? For example, more remote working, greater flexibility and the like? Perhaps if I can extend that question and think, are there any real silver linings here that could enhance productivity in the longer term?
It's a really good question, and it is one we've been grappling with. I'm reluctant to start talking about silver linings in one of the most, you know, incredible health crises and human tragedies that we've seen in a long time, and certainly one of the most sudden. That said, it is true that a whole swathe of industries, as I earlier mentioned, have worked out that work from home is possible. Certainly those conversations are happening here in the bank, where many people are thinking, well, you know, as I come back to the office, I don't particularly feel a need to come in every day. I can be productive on certain days at home. On the other hand, I think, you know, there are strong tendencies to want to go back to normal. I think one of the things that will be slowest to come back is business travel. Now that, you know, you're doing conference calls at midnight is not pleasant, but it's better than flying to the other side of the world for a two-day meeting. And so you may find that there will be changed configuration of patterns of travel and movement of people around the world. But I wouldn't underestimate the desire of people to go back to something like normal and what they thought was normal. So I think there will be some changes, but I'm always mindful that in any economic downturn, people start sort of imagining that that was because of structural change or skills mismatch, when in the end it was just about a deficiency of demand. The reason there are sort of over a million people unemployed in Australia at the moment is not because they have the wrong skills. It is because of the activity restrictions, the deficiency of demand, and the uncertainty weighing on household and business decisions. And so that's why it's important for public policy to support the economy through this period.
Thanks, Lucy. I think that's a great place to finish. So we'll bring the event to a close now. So thank you again for your engagement and particularly for answering so many questions. There's obviously a lot of interests. It's very much appreciated by the Australian Business Economist and I'm sure by our audience as well. I wish you and other senior members of the Reserve Bank all the very best in helping to navigate Australia through what is a pretty serious economic and health crisis, as you have indicated.
Thank you.